Commander Rappard, Reel 17. Now, just slightly out of line, but I'd like to ask you about the DSC that you were awarded, which, if you could explain the background to that. And
well, the background to the my award of the DSC was all associated with the operations in the Mediterranean when I was in Tarta. It transpired later that my captain, Sinjin Tirit, had recommended me for a DSC, and indeed I got one, and so did the gunnery officer in Eskimo, whose name was John Edmondson, who joined the Navy with me, now Lord Sanford. And we both got them. Now, the events which had been going on had been that by the time I'd left Tarta, we'd fired off 3.5 full outfits of ammunition in action. The most recent actions before I got the DSC had been the major last convoy to Malta, Operation Pedestal, when my captain had been charged with cowardice in the face of the enemy, etc., which I've described. And we had fired a very great deal of ammunition in the course of that convoy. We'd also rushed off afterwards to North Russia on PQ-18, where again we'd fired a vast amount of live ammunition against aircraft. We didn't have any surface action there. And I'd been responsible for sinking one of our tankers, as it happened, as well. From North Russia, we hastened back to the Mediterranean for the landings in North Africa, and then acted as close support either for the army or offensive patrols in the Narrows.
It was for all these
things were added together, and I think it was for performance as the gunnery officer of the ship, which had been in action so much.
How was it? Were you actually awarded it? Did you have to actually go and collect it from anywhere? Or?
Well, I was invited to go to the palace, but unfortunately I was also appointed to do 16 other things at the time, and I never made it. Much later in my naval career, I did go and collect an OBE, which I was awarded later, and I did actually get to the palace for that one.
Now, perhaps you'd like to comment on the way that the sea war changed after D-Day, not the day itself, but after June.
Well, I was back in HMS Byron by then, and having been preparing for the invasion and seeing these extraordinary things towed down from the shipyards to assemble in the Solent for the invasion, and protecting these convoys going up and down the East Coast and the Swept Channel from air attack and from e-boat attack, quite suddenly, the war moved towards Europe. Byron took part in the invasion plan, but not in an active way, but as a decoy. We were given a whole set of instructions as to what we were to broadcast and when, and we went out into the North Sea and squawked loudly to suggest to the enemy that we were preparing for further landings in the port of Calais. The idea being, which was effective in the end, of persuading Hitler not to allow the panzers all to concentrate on the landings themselves. Though we didn't know that at the time. That's common sense after the event. But we certainly knew we were a decoy, and we knew we had to perform at certain times, and so we did just that. But once the invasion had settled and we were not being pushed back into the sea, then we were moved fairly soon after that around to Belfast to deal with the Western approaches. One has to remember that the German submarines at that time had been equipped, a large number of them anyway, had been equipped with snorkels, which enabled them to run on their diesel engines while submerged with just a very few feet of exhaust pipe, in effect, and an air intake above the water. Which was very difficult to detect with radar or anything else. Wasn't much fun for the Germans and the submarines either, we found out later. But on the other hand, they were able to operate inshore and still have full batteries, so that if they were detected, they could stay submerged with a full battery for attack or defense, whatever was needed. And we were no longer primarily defending organized convoys from attack by submarines. We were doing offensive patrols in areas in which one could expect the submarines to gather, for example, on the approaches to Liverpool, the approaches to the south coast, if there were ships coming around the southern part of Ireland. And therefore, we were used both in the Minches, in the north part, north of the Irish Sea, and in the Irish Sea itself, coming all the way down to the Wolf Rock. We had air support inshore, too, because high-frequency radar was beginning to be fitted in the anti-submarine aircraft, and they occasionally reported that there might be a submarine in a certain area because they thought they might have detected a Schnorkel in the comparatively calm waters inshore. And the Germans themselves were finding areas where they could be fairly peaceful, not attacked on the main way, in order to recharge their batteries this way. They didn't have to surface and therefore be totally vulnerable to air attack. We therefore deployed as a group searching for submarines, which made it very much teamwork. And we would be investigating each other's contacts or joining a ship which said, I've got a certain contact. But in practice, we had to decide whether we'd detected a rock, which gave a jolly good echo, just like a submarine. And in a tide way, the rock appeared to be moving. But in fact, it was a relative movement because the ship was moving in the tide, whereas the rock was steady. Or it might be a shoal of fish, the usual problem we had in the open ocean as well. And you had to spend a lot of time deciding, for example, had you got a wreck or had you got a bottomed submarine. So there was the Admiralty kept one's wreck chart up to date as accurately as possible. But just occasionally, a submarine might be bottomed near a wreck, so you couldn't afford not to have a go with your head-thrown weapons or depth charges. And it took a long time to decide whether or not one really did have a submarine. This was confused by the fact that if you did have a submarine, then they would eject bits of dead Germans and other things out of the torpedo tubes and let diesel oil go so that you could identify them and think you'd killed them and hope you'd go away. In practice, we had to collect samples of the oil, which would be analyzed ashore when we got back to make certain it was the right sort of diesel oil that the Germans were using in their boats. And it was a painstaking task, which didn't seem to carry much risk with it, because the Germans by then knew they were pinned down in comparatively shallow water. They couldn't go deep to escape because there wasn't any deep water. And in those circumstances, if we found them, genuinely found them, then we might stay with them for 2 or 3 days while they were underwater as their air ran out, trying to open them up, trying to crack the hull and get something floating up to the surface which could not have been fired out of a torpedo tube. And in the particular case of the one in... I think in the
we'll come to that later, because that's into the new. Yes. But for the initial period, you didn't have much success as a group.
As a group, we didn't have much success, perhaps because we didn't come across any submarines, perhaps because we didn't know we'd come across submarines. And it was very difficult to tell which. The only certainty was that by operating in the area, we pinned them down so they couldn't move. If they couldn't move, they couldn't get near the shipping lanes when the small convoys or group, individual ships were coming.
Now, the next big thing that happened that I think you remember is the Murmansk convoy, which was in October 1944.
This was the second of the trips to Murmansk that I'd made, and we had a remarkably uneventful trip. My previous trip had been all too eventful, very exciting indeed, with heavy losses and air attacks and all the rest of it. We did, I think, find that we'd been detected by long-range Condor aircraft, but nothing else developed, and we have a peaceful ride up to Murmansk. When we arrived, the reception committee there was no more friendly than it had been before. And we had very strict orders that if you went ashore, you would not to go more than a very short distance away from the edge.
And I remember putting up daily orders, which told the sailors that if they did get out of line, they'd finish up in a Russian prison and probably not see the end of the war in England. In those circumstances, we didn't have many liberty men, understandably, and it was extremely cold. But we had to bear in mind we were not awfully far away from the front line of the fighting still, with soldiers knocking seven bells out of each other, Russians and Germans. It was unpleasant in the sense that it's always unpleasant to go through heavy seas up to that far north in the cold. But as a warlike exercise, it was immensely successful in that the convoy was delivered without, I think, any loss at all. I don't remember any loss on it. And we came back to do the same old things as we had before. We sank the other submarine in the southern Irish Sea. I remember we spent a long time opening it up, and eventually...
That's next year.
Yeah. Again.
On this moment, this is when the captain fell ill, though.
Yes.
On the way back. If you could go through that.
My captain on the way home, somewhere near Iceland, developed appendicitis. And it was so painful for him that he really could no longer command the ship. And so, as he couldn't get out of his cabin, I took over command of the ship. The problem was, as we had no doctor, what were we going to do about the poor chap? Because it was snow showers, cold, fairly rough. And there was a doctor in Redmill, one of our group, but how are we going to get him across? It was dark most of the time anyway, and we decided that I would transfer the doctor from Redmill to Byron. I would put a sea boat down, a whaler, and tell Redmill the moment that she slipped so that she could mark it on her radar. And Redmill would then come to the place, pick up the boat, put the doctor into it, and the same drill would be worked in reverse. Which was great. We marked the plot. We went to the place where this would be, and the boat wasn't there. I was towing something called foxes at that time, which were noisemakers designed to decoy the German naval acoustic torpedoes, we called gnats, away from the ship. I didn't want to stop because they might foul the propellers, and I didn't want to be steaming around without them because we knew that we were being shadowed by a German submarine somewhere astern of the return convoy. And we were falling astern anyway, and I didn't want to be too close to the following submarine without having these things streamed. So I decided to go round again, very poor visibility. And there was a very real chance, which I realized, that we wouldn't find the boat at all. However, the snow showers lifted, and we saw it about 200 or 300 yards away on the port beam. So I stopped the ships, cut the foxes, and we drifted down towards it. We managed to get it hooked on, cleared their deck to hoist it, but we were beam onto the sea, and I had no way of changing the direction of the ship to point it head into the sea. In those circumstances, we were rolling so much that we were rolling the iron deck underwater, so much so that the sailors who were trying to haul the boat clear of the water by hand were nearly up to the waist in water and therefore couldn't run. The effect of that was that instead of smoothly drawing the boat up to the David Head, about halfway up it stopped being hoisted because we rolled right down, and as it rolled down, it rolled back into the sea again. That meant the falls went slack. And as we rolled back, and remember we rolled something like 30 or 40 degrees in about 6.5-7 seconds, the actual acceleration was such that the falls came tight very quickly, and something pulled out of the woodwork in the boat. They were the steadying chains pulled out, and the wood parted at one point. The boat went over. The falls remained secured to it, but the boat was on its side, and all the sailors hung on to their lifelines, and the doctor hung on to his black bag and went into the sea. He wasn't all that far away from us, but we couldn't get to him easily. He'd also, unfortunately, been under the boat when we rolled down again, and I heard the boat hit him on the head. In those circumstances, it was very doubtful in my mind whether we were going to get him out of the sea within the approximately 7 minutes that you had to live in the Arctic waters. However, I had a sailor who had some skill with a lasso. And he said, "Shall I have a go?" And I said, "Yes." And I also said, "I'll take a risk, despite the fact we're being shadowed, and we'll put a 10-inch signal lamp on to light up the scene." So, very frightened that what I was doing was putting all our lives at risk because of the shadowing submarine, I mentally gave 3 minutes for picking up this doctor before we'd go and leave him, because he'd be dead anyway. I was very glad, therefore, that the sailor's lasso caught the doctor, who was lying in the water upright because of his life jacket, holding on to his black bag with one hand, apparently, and the other hand was slightly out of the water, and he caught him round the wrist and round the neck. The sailor said, "Shall I hold on?" And I ordered him to hold on. So the noose tightened around the doctor's neck and his wrist, and as we rolled away from him again, he surfed towards us across the top of the water. And because we were all being thrown off our balance, the sailor couldn't let go of the rope at the last minute, and the doctor went under the bilge keel. And as we rolled down again, he must have gone down about 20 feet under the bilge keel. I was jolly glad when he floated up in one piece the next time we rolled over, and we floated him in over the guardrails. All the sailors and the officers concerned with hoisting the boat and so on were doing a marvellous job in the circumstances. I'd come down from the bridge onto the iron deck, even though I was a captain and all the rest of it, because I was also the first lieutenant. I'd done this before. And in the circumstances, the doctor was unconscious and a bit of a mess. And so I then had the captain with appendicitis still, and the doctor unconscious and possibly with a broken skull, and German submarine not awfully far away. So putting first things first, I went back to the bridge as quick as I could and got back to the convoy as quick as I could. We'd read the book about operating on this van, because the leading sick berth attendant, who was the only medically qualified chap in the ship, had once seen an appendix operation, and he had a book on how to do it. As it was an American ship equipped with all mod con, we also had a full set of operating instruments. So we had those boiled in water to sterilize them, and considered the possibility of doing the operation ourselves if it was necessary, because we read in the book there were certain changes in temperature if the appendix burst. And it was a nice balance, in my opinion at the time, as to whether I'd kill him by trying to operate on him or watch him die because the appendix had burst. So I tried the other ships who had doctors, and curiously, none of the doctors seemed keen to transfer in the circumstances. Then in the book, we found that appendicitis was in fact a form of inflammation, and that we had sulfonamide tablets on board which were intended to deal with inflammations of that sort, like a boil. And so on balance, we decided, having consulted other doctors on the radio, to give him a triple dose of sulfonamide, which probably wouldn't kill him, but there was a chance he wouldn't have his appendix burst, rather than risk almost certainly killing him, trying to operate on him ourselves. So that's what we did. Captain himself was not mad keen on either alternative. The next day I was detached, Byron was detached from the convoy, and I was told to go to Faroe, But the captain appeared to be getting better quite quickly after that, so I went towards Orkney and kept radio silence, and jinking like a snipe on the way, because after you're used to being on a convoy screen or with other ships, you feel jolly lonely all by yourself and wonder what would happen if you were torpedoed under those conditions. And when I got to Orkney, I made a signal to say I was going back to Belfast, because he seemed reasonably good nick. Back at Belfast, there was an ambulance waiting alongside when we got alongside, and a doctor who came on board had a look at the captain, so we better get this thing out, get him off to a hospital, and number one, I gather you nearly had to operate on him. You better come along and help. So I went along to the hospital too, which I believe was taken over Campbell College, which was a school. And the operation took place a few hours, or maybe the next day, not long after we got in anyway. And I was duly rigged in the right gear to watch, and I had a brief from the doctor doing the operation. One thing nearby, he said, if you're feeling faint or anything like that, don't fall into his guts, take a pace back. So, rather grisly way, I thought, yes, all right, I'll do that. But the doctor had decided not to give my captain a full anaesthetic, so he had a local anaesthetic with a small screen on his chest, so he couldn't see what was going on himself. And I watched all the cutting and stopping the little bleeders bleeding and so on. And we worked our way inside my captain until we found the appendix, which the doctor put his finger around and held it up. He said, oh, this thing's been going a long time, hasn't it, oh boy, said to the captain. He said, well, I've had tummy trouble for a bit, said the captain. Quite clearly he hadn't admitted how bad it was. Oh, we'd better have this off, he said. So he did all the things you do to snip it off. And I began to feel a bit swimmy at that stage and took a pace back and passed out. Next thing I remember was being dragged backwards through the door of the room which was being used as an operating theatre by a nurse who was laughing like mad at the idea of my passing out. And the first thing I heard after the laughter was the doctor saying, tell that bloody first attendant to buck up and come back, we're waiting for him. So I pulled myself together and reeled back into the operating theatre, and I had to go past the north end of my captain, who looked at me in a very worried way and said, are you all right, old boy? Whereas the other side of the screen, all his guts were hanging out. So I was seriously concerned that I was going to faint again, but didn't. I have never watched an appendix operation since. I think once is probably enough unless you're a doctor. Although I did have to sew up somebody in the ship one day when the sick berth tiffy was ashore and they felt it was badly cut. Didn't like doing it one little bit.
That was the end of Southcombe, obviously, as far as the ship was
Southcombe
concerned.
Southcombe left. He stayed in hospital, of course, to recover. And argument started about who should succeed him. Lieutenant Commander Hart, who was the escort group commander of 21st Escort Group, in which we were, suggested that I should take over. But I really wasn't very old. I was about 23. And the Admiralty didn't like the idea one little bit. So eventually, another lieutenant, who was about 2 or 3 years older than me, was appointed to command the ship, and I remained as first lieutenant.
Now, this was John Burfield. What did you think of John Burfield?
He was younger than Southcombe. He was a lieutenant, which was my rank, Lieutenant RN. And I didn't really get to know him as a person. He was very much the captain, and I was very much the first lieutenant. And clearly he had heard or found out the curious things that had gone on in the relationships between Southcombe and me earlier on. And he was rather more formal. And therefore I never got to know him well. Never met him again after I left the ship, either. I understand that he died a couple of years ago, 2 or 3 years ago.
Now, the ship was then on these anti-submarine sweeps.
Yes, again. We had been enabled to go over on the offensive. Rather than escorting convoys, we were seeking out the submarines where they were waiting for ships to pass by and keeping their heads down while the convoys or individual ships went by. This was immensely satisfying for us because we had felt and actually been on the defensive for years in the war, constantly at the receiving end of all the horrors, and here we were dishing it out, which was really an encouraging, positive thing to feel. The sailors felt it too, I'm quite certain. The ship's company were aware of it. And they began to feel that at last we were quite definitely on the winning side.
Now, one thing, before you had your first success, there was a collision in December with the Tannet side. Do you remember that?
I was asleep in my bunk in my cabin when there was one heck of a crash, and I shot out of my bunk. I always slept in my clothes and life jacket anyway. Jumped out into my sea boots, ran up to the bridge, and found the ship stopped with another ship lying not terribly far away ahead off the Welsh coast somewhere. And in the darkness, I didn't know what had happened, so I said, first turn here to the captain, and he said, collision forward, go down and see what needs to be done. So I ran down below, went forward, and as I went through the mess decks forward, and the ship was rising and falling in the seaway, with the bows going down into the water every time, there was a noise I'd never heard before in a ship, that of water coming in and sloshing about, and the pressure of air around my ears changing. As the bows went down, the pressure increased. As it went up, it decreased again. And the damage control parties starting to get there. But just before I left the bridge, the old gunner had turned up. He'd warrant officer. He'd been a chief gunner's mate for a long time before the war. And he arrived up, half asleep, saying, I smell cordite. There wasn't any cordite, but I remember it vividly that he was convinced there was a battle on. The crash had been something to do with guns. But down below, the damage control parties were starting to shore up the forward bulkheads because the water had come in. We were able to shut off the small forward compartments. But we needed to keep them watertight, and we needed to stop the flooding going through the next bulkhead, so we shored up the next bulkhead instead. And we had to proceed fairly carefully and not too fast, to avoid added pressure. But we were able to make way. We'd hit Tannetside clearly somewhere in the middle, but I couldn't see her as we fell away in the dark, and I never really found out precisely what damage we did to her.
And that led to a period in docks.
We then had to be mended because our bows were bent and perforated and so on. So we went back to dock, I think at Pollock Dock. I can't remember where it was. Was it Pollock Dock again? Dry dock, which is rather fun because you have a bit of shore time. But it didn't last all that long. The damage was remarkably little in the circumstances. As we welded ship, they just cut the bits off and re-welded new bits onto it.